Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Bosses are stupid a lot of the time. I'm going to give you three examples. These are three absolutely foolish, utterly dumb workplace practices that are, to use a not dumb term, hegemonic, dominant in today's workplaces. At the top of the list is open workspaces. And I'm going to be asking you in a few minutes to call in and you tell me whether you think I'm the one who's being an idiot. 70% of U.S. offices have open workspaces. That's usually done to enhance collaboration. But even a child could have predicted that open workspaces would cause too much noise, temptation to chat, and of course, in turn, lower productivity. And that has indeed turned out to be the case. The New Yorker, of all places, did a review of the literature, and they found the open workplace to be a one-idea wrecking crew. For example, a large energy company studied the effects of its conversion to open workspaces. Here is the summary result. Quote, the new space was disruptive, stressful, and cumbersome. And instead of feeling closer, coworkers felt distant, dissatisfied, and resentful. Productivity fell. End quote. But that's just one place. A review of 100 studies of open workspaces concludes that it damages the workers' attention spans, productivity, creative thinking, and satisfaction. Not covered in the New Yorker review, according to a 2017 survey, a majority of high-performing employees in open workspaces find them distracting, and those high performers crave more private space. Should your work group rise up and demand more private offices, meeting rooms, and walls, or at least cubicle wall extenders that rise to the ceiling, plus foam paneling on the cubicle walls? Or should you at least ask for an all-staff meeting to encourage decibel dropping, or at least the right to wear headphones? What do you think? The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, if you want to agree, disagree, think I'm just being pompous and a blowhard, or you think I'm right. What do you think? Have we gone way too, just like in the schools in the 70s, they opened the classrooms, they took down the classroom walls until they found that it was chaos, and then they put the walls back up. Do you think we are at the cusp of where this silliness, this employer silliness about open workspaces has run its course? Or do you think I'm just not collaborative enough? The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I said I was going to I'm going to present three foolish workplace practices. Number two, in hiring, they undervalue job simulations and overvalue resumes, the ultimate BS documents, degrees, which attest too often to very little. Certainly not very much that attests to what real-world competence, interviews that are so BS-prone, and references, which may be even more BS-prone. Hiring has changed little in eons. Sure, employers may post job openings on LinkedIn instead of a newspaper. They may use automated tracking systems to filter resumes. But the actual hiring decision-making is as out of date as an 8-track player. Hiring is still based on resumes, interviews, degrees, and references. They are all notoriously invalid. You see, employees use resumes. It's not just a recitation of a candidate's job history, but the employee uses as evidence of a person's ability to organize, to think, and to write. Those are key to most jobs. Unfortunately, weak candidates, especially, are ever more likely to spring for a professional resume writer. It's no more ethical than a college-bound kid hiring somebody to write their college essays. So employers may end up picking the best resume writer rather than the best candidate. And alas, with competition for good jobs fierce, a candidate, knowing he or she is unlikely to be top of the pile, can be tempted to write, oh, I was a consultant rather than unemployed. Stupid employers. Employers use college degrees as a screening tool, right? After all, a degree ostensibly attests to perseverance, if not to more job-related expertise than could have been acquired if you had spent all those years in the real world. And requiring a degree is a quick screener. The employer tells the admin, only interview candidates with the right degree and maybe even from the right institutions. But there is often, as you know, a grand canyon of difference between ability to do well in school and to do well in the real world on the job. Don't we all know people who did fine in school and poorly in the real world? Stupid employer. Interviews. They're also too coachable. It is laughable that employers continue to use stock questions. Tell me about yourself. Why do you want to work here? What are your greatest strengths and weaknesses? Tell me about a project you worked on. Applicants can, and they do, script answers to such commonly asked questions, too often using the aforementioned creative writing. Stupid employers. References. They are subject to more grade inflation even than college grades are. Even an abysmal job applicant can usually gin up a few references willing to attest to their magnificence, even if they have to convince their main squeeze to pretend to be their former boss. Stupid employers. Those selection methods are dramatically inferior to asking job candidates in the initial screening to answer an emailed quiz that taps ability to do the job's common, difficult tasks. And in the interview, to participate in simulations of like tasks like that. And that is commonly done in selecting technical employees, but that idea is much more broadly applicable. For example, have applicants for management positions lead discussion of one agenda item in a mock meeting. If the employee is going to be expected to make presentations on short notice, when they arrive at the interview, give the candidate information needed to prepare, and then during the interview, give a 5-minute presentation. Doesn't that make sense as a far more valid way to choose an employee, those simulations, rather than overvaluing resumes, degrees, interviews, references? What do you think? If you are somebody who maybe, if you've been a manager, a boss, who's been burned by the resume, interview, degree, references approach and want to tell the tale, or maybe you want to defend it. Again, we're an equal opportunity show here. So whether you agree or disagree with me, as long as it's thoughtful, we welcome your call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, either because you want to embrace or criticize open workspaces or embrace or criticize the hiring practices as using job simulations, not using job simulations, using resumes. And by the way, if you had a success experience in using job simulations, certainly want to hear that too. Those are all good reasons to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And I like to keep my promises. I said there were three foolish workplace practices that I wanted to expose the stupid boss. And the third one is overusing team input and decision-making. Yes, teams have values. A societal megatrend is to decrease hierarchy, question authority, speak truth to power, trust the people more. And a workplace manifestation is the increase in team input. Bosses who too often make decisions without substantial team involvement are likely to be viewed as atavistic or worse than that. Troglodyte. I like that word. Like an old dinosaur. Unfortunately, too many workplaces, and I have seen this again and again, I have been a consultant to a number of corporations, nonprofits, government agencies, and too many workplaces have been ground into torpor, inaction, by too frequent use of group input. It slows down decision-making and costs more because multiple employees' time is used. They'd rather be doing their work. Instead, they're sitting in this endless attempt to gain consensus. Besides, and this is kind of an unspoken truth, but it is true, while sometimes people get promoted to higher-level positions because they slept with the boss or some other not merit-based factors, managers and leaders usually get promoted because they are better at decision-making. Team decision-making tends to dilute excellence. Meanwhile, competent employees lose motivation because they face a no-win. If they show their ability a lot, they're viewed as, full of themselves. But if they hold back, They're submerging their essence. Plus, with pay increasingly determined by group performance, the high performers lose, and again, fans, forgive the fancy word, pecuniary incentive, financial incentive for working hard. And to boot, when a decision is made by consensus, it tends to be tepid rather than bold. It's the decision that everyone can agree on, the lowest common denominator. The cliche about such workplaces is, here it takes three signatures to get to blow your nose. In an era in which change is so rapid, the turgid, consensus-driven workplace really too often results in all its employees being treated equally all right, equally unemployed. The wise boss resists undue pressure to collaborate and case by case decides whether the speed and boldness of solo effort, individual effort, outweighs the benefits of groupness. They say, no, there is no I in team. But there should be. What do you think? I think that the pendulum has gone way too far to this team collaborative workplace. How many of my clients are always telling me, I can't believe how many meetings I have to sit through. Oh my God, I'd rather just do my work. So I have tried to outline three what I consider absolutely idiotic workplace practices by stupid bosses, stupid employers. One is the open workspace. Two is that hiring is done primarily based on resumes, degrees, interviews, and references, and not on job simulations. And three, the overuse. Yes, sometimes team decision-making is appropriate. Team input is often appropriate, absolutely. But the overuse of those. Do you think I'm right? Do you think I'm wrong? I welcome your calls for that. And as well, if you have a work-related problem of any sort in your own personal life, if you, whether you're 16 or 76, unemployed or well-employed and still unhappy, working for the government, working for a nonprofit, self-employed, or you want me to play Shark Tank with you, you know, you want to run this business idea by me and I'll either tell you whether I'd invest in it or not. I wouldn't actually, though either way, I don't have enough money like those Shark Tank guys. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Now, I have all of my career counseling clients complete a new client questionnaire before coming in. And so that we can really hit the ground running. You know, we've all been to counselors, and after the first session, all we can say is, that's all I didn't really get very much out of the first session. And they say, it's only the first session. I don't like that. I want my clients to walk out of session one with their head spinning, feeling they got all these great ideas. And so one of the tricks that I've used, as I just said, I send in advance of the first session a questionnaire, like a doctor would, except I'm not asking about your blood pressure. Questions that are likely to tease out some clues as to what kind of career you might pursue, what the problem, you know, et cetera. Mainly, for purposes of today, these are the questions I'm going to be reading to you are those that are designed to tease out what career you might pursue. So if you or someone you love is still not sure what they want to be when you grow up, even if you're already 60, you might find these 20 questions useful. So I'm going to read, and these are, you know, this is my new version. I revised it, frankly, this week. I've constantly iterated my questionnaire development over the last 29 years, but this is a brand. I decided to start from scratch. By the way, we are often ball and chained to our previous practices, and sometimes, just like an author who's writing a book and it feels like it's not coming out right, the wisest thing he or she could do would be to scrap the damn thing and start from scratch. I decided as an exercise today, this week, to pretend I didn't have a new client questionnaire. And if I was starting from scratch, what would be the items I'd put on it? So that my brain filters out the items that really weren't that valuable to my clients in the past and filters in the ones that were. So here are the 20 questions I came up with this week. The first three are about your abilities. What do you find easy that other smart people find hard? Two, what has been your peak accomplishment that has career implications? No, I don't care if you played in this freebie band in high school, but what has been your peak accomplishment that has career implications for what you might do? Three, what is your best ability or skill? Sometimes just asking directly. In your heart of hearts, you know, mine is thinking on my feet. whether it's writing, counseling, or doing this radio show. I like to, you know, I have many weaknesses. I can't fix squat. I'm horrible on a team. But I can think on my feet. At least I think so. So what's your best skill or ability? Okay, next two questions are about your career desires. What are your career non-negotiables? For example, is it big money? Like at the end of the philosophy talk, before they were talking about, you know, stock traders and bond traders and whatever. Is it big money? Is it non-profit work? Is it a career that allows ample time for home and family? Is it an artsy creative gig? What are your... Is it a commute? I mean, the commute is getting crazier and crazier here in the Bay Area. Is your one of your career non-negotiables a commute that takes less than 30 minutes, which means it's probably going to be four blocks from your house? Next question in your career desires. Is there a certain kind of person you know you'd like to work with? Maybe special needs children, healthy adults, brilliant adults, older people, or would you rather work mainly alone? Next set of questions is your motivators. What's a work project or two during which you came alive? Maybe even lost track of time. What does that suggest about what motivates you? Next question. What would motivate you to work hard? Is it money? Showing off? Anger about a product or service or about Donald Trump or whatever? Adrenaline? A cause? Something else? Question 8. What's an unusual, even weird, interest of yours that you could turn into a career or at least a sideline? The more unusual or weird the interest, the less competition. If you have an interest in entomology, you like insects, there isn't going to be as much competition as if you want to save the environment. Next question. Have you or someone you care about suffered an adversity that suggests a career you'd want to pursue? If, let's say, your lover suffers from severe depression, you see the huge toll that takes on your life. And you say, damn it, you know, maybe I want to go back to school and learn how to become a researcher in depression, or learn the art of counseling depressed people, or whatever the hell it is. But sometimes in adversity, something you say, I want nothing to do with that. Oh my God, I live with depression all day and all night. The last thing I want to do is deal with depression. But other times, it's what fuels you. Question 9, 10. If you had $1 million to give to a specific nonprofit or invest in a specific company, what would it be? What could you, at least with training, do well for that organization? Next question is about your connections. Because so often there's many careers that you could do probably equally well, and it's a matter of which door happens to be relatively open for you. So do you know a wealthy or a well-connected, or an eminent, or simply a highly skilled person who could open an interesting career door for you that you otherwise couldn't get open? Important. That's an underappreciated question. We career counselor types tend to think there is this magical one career that is quintessentially you. By the time you're 20 or 30, let alone 50, you know, if you were meant to be a ballet dancer, you would have known that by now. Or a computer game programmer. Or a salesperson. But by this time, if you're interested in this questionnaire, there's probably not that one quintessentially perfect career for you. And so sometimes having that career door opener may be the tipper. And now a bunch of holistic questions. These overlap hugely. But sometimes the process of choosing a career should be more organic. It's not a matter of identify your skills, your interests, your values. And that. Sometimes it's really holistic, organic. So here are some organic questions that could help you just pick a career. What would God or the goddess or your all-knowing twin, if you're an atheist like me, tell you to do? What career does your most trusted family member or friend think you should pursue? What are your parents' careers? Does that suggest a career for you? A parent's knowledge, their network, their genes often argue for pursuing your parents' career or a variant thereof. Is there a not sexy career that might interest you? I'm referring here to careers other than entertainment, high-tech, fashion, environment, physician, lawyer, because competition is less rigorous in other fields, so it's easier to get a good job and to rise in one. In radio, it is well known it is fun to do radio. It is cool to do radio. So to get paid to do radio more than amount that's going to enable you to eat on cat food and ramen is not so easy. But if you choose something less sexy, less popular, I know somebody who got into scrap metal and made a fortune, is a broker of scrap metal, because nobody wants to do that, and they treat them very well. Oh, you know, we'll give you a raise. Oh, do you want to work from home one day a week? Oh, they don't do that in radio, because they know there are 10,000 other wannabes scratching at the door. Let me in, wee you, let me in. Next question. What's the simplest and thus lowest risk business you could see starting? I really believe in these low risk, low status businesses because, again, fancy Bay Area people, they are status driven. Oh, high tech. Oh, biotech. No, where if as long as it's ethical, status can be the enemy of contentment. It's far lower risk to own a small chain of flower carts. It's never going to go out of style. You're not dealing with geniuses generally. Or laundromats that are not grungy, disgusting places that maybe have music playing, maybe a little bookstore in them or whatever. I know a guy who made a lot of money, would you believe, selling sports caps near stadium parking lots by putting them on his head. And he had a bunch of his friends. He had this, remember that book, Caps for Sale, from a children's book? He had like 30 caps, and so the caps would stick up so that everybody would see it. It's illegal for some stupid reason to be and do it in the parking lot. But near the parking lot, he had like 50 caps or 30 caps sitting on top of his head. He made a lot of money. Bought them for a dollar or two and sold them for 10. And there's much lower risk than, I think I'm going to open a boutique, where the rent meter ticks, tick, 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 like a taxi meter, 24/7, 365. Status can be the enemy of contentment. Next question. If you didn't care what anyone thought, what is your most deeply held aspiration? Next question. If you acted like a true grown-up, there's a lot of people who just, even if they're 50, they suffer from what I call the Peter Pan syndrome. They refuse to grow up. If you acted like a true grown-up, what career would you pursue? Question 19. If you had to pick a career right now, I put a gun to your head and say, you got to choose now or die. What would you pick? And finally, the most direct question, holistic question of all. What would be the wisest career for you? Some people deep down know, but they just haven't been asked that directly. So anyway, phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco. If you have a career question of any sort, the phone number here at KELW, Work with Marty Nemco, the price is right, 0 zippo nada, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Now, I am an addicted writer. I've written 3,200 nationally published articles, and now my ninth book just came out. It's called Modern Fables. I've always felt that the how-to article suffered from aridity, from dryness in general, and pontification. And so I decided to take whatever ability I have in writing short stories and screenplays and incorporate that into these modern fables so that hopefully they're more interesting and less pontificating. So I thought I would read one to you. This is about somebody who loved music and wanted a career in music. And I'm curious what you think. This is going to take me about 5 minutes to read the thing. And afterwards, I'm going to ask you to call in and tell me what advice you'd give our main character. I call him Eli. Eli majored in his love, music composition. But he also took psychology and business courses because he was urged to have a practical backup. He played oboe in the college orchestra and became more optimistic about his musical future when one of his compositions was selected to be performed by that orchestra. He was additionally buoyed by having become first oboist in the community orchestra, which included many members old enough to be his parent. It was there that he met and fell in love with Deborah, a violinist. 6 months later, after he graduated, they got married. Her day job was in hospital administration, which made her scared of having a baby, having heard horror stories and read enough statistics to know that fear of hospitals is understandable. 300,000 to 400,000 people a year die of hospital errors every year. Nevertheless, 10 months later, Deborah was pregnant. Knowing she'd soon have to bear, he would soon have to bear the financial responsibilities of fatherhood, Eli decided to be practical and backburnered his dream of a music career, and instead tried to find a way to make a living that combined his psychology and his business courses. He discovered that nearly all counseling jobs required certifications, which meant at least a master's degree plus 3,000 supervised hours. With Deborah wanting to take 6 months or so, at least, off of maternity leave, and knowing that many women take off longer or at least go part-time, he needed to make money now, not spend it on school, even if long-term a graduate degree might have been a worthwhile investment. So Eli decided to try his hand at financial recovery coaching, helping spendaholics to realize that their emotional hole is unlikely to stay filled by buying stuff. That practice's core belief is that, like other addictions, trying to buy your way to contentment is more likely to result in a hedonic treadmill, spending more and more to get that temporary shopper's high that fades ever more quickly. Because Deborah had a rich network of friends, she helped him launch a practice that quickly generated decent income. Alas, when Deborah went into labor a month premature, her fear of hospitals was vindicated. The nurse put epidural painkiller in her intravenous line instead of the intended penicillin for treating a labor-caused infection. The epidural drug caused cardiac arrest, and Deborah and the baby died. Eli was beyond bereft, and not only canceled all his clients, but refused to see anybody for 2 months. During that time, he mainly stayed in his apartment and took long walks. Seeing life's transience, he decided to take a more focused stab at his dream career, music composer for films. Knowing that was a risky goal, Eli moved to a cheaper apartment and otherwise cut his expenses. He worked 6 hours a day for 2 months to create a demo MP3 of his compositions and sent it to 20 major Hollywood film producers. He received 18 no responses and 2 polite rejections, both saying that his compositions weren't good enough to yield professional employment. One of them was kind enough to say, "Not good enough yet." Eli deliberated whether to return to financial recovery coaching or spend on a master's degree in music composition or try to gain those skills on his own, full or part-time, while coaching. He decided to circle a date on his calendar 9 months from that day and promised himself that he would, quote, "kill myself between now and then" to get as good as possible at composing. Living in virtual solitude, he spent most of his waking hours reading articles and books on composition, listening to Oscar-winning film scores and making notes, and incorporating everything he was learning into his own compositions. When he feels good enough about a composition, he plans to send it to a dozen successful film composers, asking for honest feedback. It remains to be seen whether his self-imposed solitude pays off. So, what do you think? Many of these short stories my book Modern Fables deliberately have an ambiguous ending. They're not either happy nor sad, but left in the middle, because that's life in the real world. But what do you think? What advice would you have for Eli? And as a special inducement to call, the first 3 callers to render either an opinion about what Eli should do, or, I feel generous. The first 3 callers to call for any reason, if you want career help or whatever, not only will I give you career help, but I will give you a free autographed copy of my just published this month book, Modern Fables. Phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco for what I call a workover. No pummeling involved, usually. The phone number 415-841 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And while we're waiting for the calls, one of the things that I do to try to stay current and is every time and keep my new knowledge fresh is every time I come up with a new idea or read a new idea that I think is worthy, I record it as a tweet. And so, and that also forces me to essentialize, to distill. And I've come to believe the older I get that we're more likely to change as the result of a bumper sticker, as a result of something short, than a long tome. So I've collected these tweets and then curated them, the best of them, to read to you. So let me do a couple of those here right now. So, and by the way, you don't need to call. All lines are lighted up. So in a minute, as soon as we get the calls processed here, we'll go to the phones. But here are some tweets that I've done recently. The media, especially in movies, novels, and plays, assert that most wealth is ill-begotten. To what extent do you believe that's true? That was one tweet. I think most people do, you know, some that most people do, they delay gratification. They go to school for a long time. They do take jobs, not necessarily those that they love. And most people do work hard. I see people working awfully hard. So next tweet. Do enough people ask, to what extent is privilege earned? Next tweet. I think that term privilege implies that everybody, you know, who's successful or who is just gotten it because of their gender, race, or sexual orientation or whatever. And I think that's simplistic. I think, at least in my, I've been around a while and seen lots and lots of clients. I think a lot of the people who are successful really do earn it. It isn't born with a silver spoon. Anyway, next tweet. To be satisfied with your work life, you must come to realize that ethical excellence is all the reward you need to justify working hard. Really, I understand you need to make a living. We all need to make a living. But I've seen so many people do the minimum work because they're not getting paid well. And then they end up always feeling unhappy. As corny as it sounds, by feeling you're doing as excellent a job as you can and being ethical, even if it's volunteer work, that should be sufficient reward. Can we go to the phones? Okay, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. Hello. Hi. My name is Lorenzo.
Hi, Lorenzo.
Hi. I've been trying to spend the last 10 years or so trying to figure out what I want to do for graduate work.
Uh-huh.
I studied undergraduate at Oberlin. I studied neuropsychology and aeronautical engineering. And I just trying to figure out where to go next. I'm not trying to become a billionaire or a millionaire, but $250,000 sounds like enough money so I can hand out to other people should I want to. And
right.
I'm just trying to figure out if I should go the neuroscience, humanities, helping people route, or if I should spend a little bit more time in a tech world, you know?
Well, aerospace is kind of, unfortunately, is, you know, it's very unpopular here in the Bay Area, and there's very little. Whatever exists is in Southern California. It's the Raytheons of the world.
Yes.
You know, I do think that we are going to be in an era. Trump is somebody who is a relatively isolationist person, and while he supports an increase in military budget, it's hard for me to see. First of all, I think he's going to get thrown out of office. I really do.
Right. No, for sure, for sure.
And I think that I just don't see us making major investments in the military. And
right.
If you're planning,
well,
if you went to
any real tech would be nice.
Okay, but I am. You implied the neuropsych, but I think you implied it meaning something different than what I'm talking about. If you were to, you know, neuropsych is sometimes referred to, atypical people, helping people with autism or whatever. But I think if you're going to graduate school, it is my belief that we are learning ever more that diseases from autism to Alzheimer's, from retardation to depression, is heavily, not completely, physiologically based. And so in the arc of your lifetime, when you're going to graduate school now, you're trying to make an investment that is going to be paying off for 10 to 30 years or longer. And I believe in the arc of your lifetime, the physiological both at a clinical and at a research level, is going to be ever more about the physiology. The old-fashioned Freudian psychologist is already dead, but even cognitive behavioral therapy and stuff like that is likely to wane, because those are incomplete, very incomplete solutions. So if we were, you know, given those two choices, I would try to find an excellent, and I'm being a little too in the weeds here, but I need to in order to be helpful to you. We are learning, for example, that so much of what goes on is not just at the hormonal level, but at this neural circuit level.
Exactly.
It's all about the translation of DNA to proteins, to the expression of those proteins. That's bottom up. And then what considers top down, what goes on at the circuit level, neurons, circuit level, what is the causal chain? And it seems to me that sounds simple, but it is an enormously complex problem that is very specific to specific disorders. Okay, then hopefully he's still hearing. What I would encourage you to do would be to pick one disease process, or simply cognitive reasoning or whatever. Pick one process that you emotionally have a great affinity toward, either because you've just, you know, I'm a big believer in the importance of reasoning skills, so I care a lot about that. But other people may have a cousin who's got autism. Pick a particular disease process. Find out which graduate schools in the country have the best programs for the best researchers studying that, the neural and or proteomic bases for those diseases, and go and get a graduate program, go get a graduate degree in that. And then you must, because if I was honored to be the career counselor for the Society for Neuroscience at their last convention, and there was huge numbers of people coming to my sessions who had PhDs and were unemployed. So the problem was they were general. So it is appropriate at this stage in history to commit to a niche up front. Find something that you could stay with, but find the two or three or five universities that have at least one great professor who's a specialist in that niche. Apply to those five schools and explain that you chose those schools to apply to very carefully, and that you would like to work underneath his or her aegis as his research assistant. That will help you get the training you need to become hireable afterwards. And that is my best advice. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty. And, we lost the call, so he can't get a free book. So, okay, let's go back to the phones. Hopefully the next person we will not
lose. Thank you very much.
Oh, are you there? I guess you were there.
I'm still here. Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Great. You heard all that.
I heard all of it.
Okay, was that helpful?
Yes, it was extremely helpful. Thank you so much.
Okay, now I promised the first three callers they get a free autographed copy of my new book, Modern Fables. So if you'll stay on the line, and my wonderful board operator, Jean Marie, will take your address, and I will mail you one myself. How's that?
Thank you so much. I look forward to it.
Okay. But I need to hear your reaction. I went and pontificated because I thought you were off the air. What do you think of my idea?
No, I think it's an amazing idea. That's exactly the route people have been telling me, and I guess I really wanted to hear it from somebody who seems like they really got their feet on the ground and know what they're doing. I really need to kind of get into that beautiful niche that I can really appreciate and really have a passion for, and then move forward just like that. Yeah.
Indeed, the secret is finding those few professors who are well funded to do research on that area. And it may, you know, sometimes, really, unfortunately, in these fields, there's only a few schools that are really big time in it. There's MIT, there's Carnegie Mellon, there's Caltech, there is, and Stanford, definitely. I know NYU has a significant program, so is Columbia. There's only and then there's Cold Spring Harbor, the Rockefeller University in New York, Cold Spring Harbor on Long Island. There's a relatively small number of these places that get big money, and you want to be working as their research slave.
I love it.
Okay, take care.
Thank you.
Bye. Okay, let's go. Our lines are lighted up. So let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It is your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, good morning, Marty. I'm enjoying your many voices. It's very entertaining.
Thank you. I try.
But, you know, sometimes the mimicry can border on making fun of people, so I just wanted to give you that little bit of feedback.
Okay.
And also, I just wanted to say about people who, this notion of hard work, what does it even mean? Because I know people who are extremely wealthy, who've been very successful, only because, and they've worked, but, you know, they have had a big head start at the beginning with family money and other possible forms of support. And whereas the hardworking person who isn't born with inheritance or is given a big endowment to kick off his dreams can work just as hard and not get very far, because it's not an equal balance.
Yeah, you're turning the water running in water. Yeah. Anyway, I understand what you're saying. At least in my experience, while there are certainly, it's not just a matter of working hard, and there are some people who are born with a silver spoon, but net across the world I can only tell you my own experience, because I've had 5,200 clients, and I live for work. I spend a lot of time even at parties talking about work. I have seen that people who are three attributes. They're smart, they're hardworking, they're four things. They're practical. They don't, you know, they may love stamp collecting or music or art, but they end up saying, no, that's not going to be remunerative, and it's not going to make that biggest difference if I'm a poetry reader. So in general, while there are exceptions, I have found that in general, we too quickly default to saying that people achieve success because of privilege and don't acknowledge the incredible amount of work. I'm very fortunate. I have a lot of clients who are quite successful. They're doctors and they're lawyers and executives. That's real strugglers too. But when I see how hard those doctors work, 70 hours a week, and dealing with paperwork and insurance and government restrictions and workers who are unreliable, and when I see how many, talk about nonprofit executives too, in the foreign nonprofit sector, how many of them work 70 hours a week and are smart, and they went and they got an MBA when they really didn't want to learn that mathematics crap, but they did because they know they needed to. And I see, I'm picturing one of them now who has faces ashen. He's only 55, but he's worked 60 or 70 hours a week, and he brings healthy cleaning products. I'll just say that. He's a general manager for a major corporation that has brought healthy cleaning products to the world. I bet he's going to get a heart attack. And I don't care whether he was born in a silver spoon or not. For us to simply wipe them away with a brush of our hand and call it privilege is obscene. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with
Please
Marty.
Hang up and try again.
All the lines are lighted up, so let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Are you there? Hello.
Are you there? Can you hear me?
Yes, beautifully.
Good. Because my phone's acting up. First of all, with regard to your short story, I guess my solution would be that the guy should go back part-time to doing what he was doing with the financial counseling and then keep doing the other thing before he gets himself really depressed.
Okay, yeah. You know, in the end, everybody is different, but if I had generic advice, it would be get yourself at least a stable income so you're not living with seven roommates and a fear of being homeless. But
which
then
segues into my question.
Okay, I'm hearing echoing. Do you want to turn
career advice?
Hold on a minute, please. Hold on a minute.
I do legal headhunting and I do partner placement and firm mergers. And you said that takes a
okay. Your phone is acting up. We can't hear you, and it's really difficult for my first allegiance is to my listeners, and it's either your phone or you haven't turned your radio down. So I'm going to ask you.
I turn my radio down. It's my phone. So what do you want me to do?
Unfortunately, we can't hear with that. Your phone is acting up. You're true to your word, and it's not acceptable for my listeners to listen to that. So
okay.
I'm going to have to ask you to call back from on a different phone. But okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye bye. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air.
Hello. Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. You sound perfect.
Okay. Great. Okay. So I have a full-time job and it's going great, and I am interested in adding sort of some side work into it that's a little bit more creative.
Okay.
So I was just looking at Craigslist and I found an ad for somebody who wanted a mentor. Mm-hmm. And I just had my first meeting with her.
Wow.
And I'm excited about it because it seems like she is working on a lot of creative projects and she just needs somebody to kind of help her.
Awesome.
Yeah. So,
if you'd like to make a call, please hang up and try again. If you need help, hang up and then dial your operator.
I need to tell my board operator. I think you're using the hybrid. You're probably having two people on the line at the same time. Can you get rid of the one who's... Okay. All right. I'm sorry. I'm back. Do I have the right person? Do I have the person on the line who's the mentor?
If you need help.
Oh. Yeah, that's me. So,
oh, great.
Yeah, I was hearing something else on the line, too.
Oh, perfect. We're good now. So we're
okay.
Good.
Yeah. So what would you recommend for me to be able to help this person? It seems like it's kind of like a mentor or like a life coaching type of thing, which is I'm excited about. And also for coming up with how I can charge her for my time.
Great. So you said all I was able to hear before we had some problems on the line was that she's doing some kind of creative work. Do you know what her goal is? What is she trying to accomplish?
She is going to be applying to art school, so she wants to come up with a portfolio. So she's basically just been like doing a lot of different things. And
are you on a speakerphone now? Now you're sounding distant. Are you?
Is that better?
Please, talking to the phone.
Yeah, okay,
you're on the radio. We need to hear you clearly. Okay.
Okay.
So, right. So but the key would be to be asking her questions that would lead to baby steps. You know, saying, okay, you want a portfolio. How many items would you want in your portfolio? What would they be like? Okay, what's the first baby step toward getting one? Is it doing a first rough draft on a piece of paper? Is it showing that rough draft to an expert? Is it reading some stuff first or looking at videos or whatever? It's like helping her, but not prescribing to her, but asking her questions that will tease out the baby steps. And once she's got the baby steps, then you're going to ask her, okay, how can I be of help to you? Is it being a loving nag? Is it running ideas by me? Do you want me to listen to you as you run your ideas by me? So it's asking a lot of questions to help her develop baby steps and then succeed. Now, that's generic advice. Does your intuition tell you that that would work with this person? Are you there? I've lost her. Okay. Let's go to the phones and see who's there. Okay, welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. Hi, are you there?
Hello?
Hi. Welcome.
Oh, hey. What's going on? Sorry, I've been disconnected like four times, so I wasn't sure if I was actually on the air.
I see.
Anyway, thank you so much for putting me on the air and giving me this opportunity to ask a question. But my name is John, and I'm currently in my second year of medical school.
Mm.
And it's a very long process. I don't know if you're familiar with the route of medical school.
You know, I teach at UCSF,
in
medical school.
Great.
In the medical
right,
school, so I know the process.
Excellent. Sorry, I forgive my ignorance there.
That's all right.
This is my first time tuning in, and I thought I'd give you all a call. So I'm about 30, and I was considering, like, you know, another career that had a faster track to just starting to work and getting my life together, like a physician assistant program.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Just because, I mean, I don't know. I just want to kind of get my life going. I'm not getting any younger. My parents aren't getting any younger. I kind of want to start a family and, like, you know, a life. And, you know, with the medical school route, it's like another 2 years of schooling, and then I have 3 years of residency. And that's going to be before, you know, I can make, like, the income I need to kind of, like, develop the dream that I want to achieve.
Yeah,
so,
and then maybe a fellowship after your residency. A lot of people are going on for a fellowship after that. And the cost. I mean, even the cost of it, even a public institution like UCSF is like $300,000. It's crazy. And, you know, you have all my, you said physician assistant, you have all my support. I think that projecting over the arc of your lifetime, somebody who's 30-ish, who's going to be working for another 40 years or whatever, I think physician assistant is going to be the job of the future because we are moving to single payer. We are going to cover everybody. And if we cover everybody, we are not going to, and most of the people who are additionally covered, not currently, are low payers and have high need or no payers and have high need. So we're going to be downscaling the quality of the of service providers. Not everybody's going to be, most people are not going to be seeing doctors. They're not going to be seeing physical therapists. They're going to be seeing physical therapy assistants. They're going to be seeing physician assistants. And so you're probably going to end up making a six-figure salary. and doing much of what doctors do. And because you already were good enough to get into medical school, the chances are while now it's really hard to get into PA school, physician assistant school, because you've already been in medical school, they may jump at you, and you may really get a shot. So you have my total support on that.
Excellent. Yeah, I mean, that was my biggest question. You were just talking about when you want to, achieve something great, you have to take a risk. And, I mean, that would be the risk, leaving my medical school and trying to find a PA school and then, hoping to get into one.
I wouldn't leave medical school. So I would try to make conversations with the PA. I know there's one in Davis. There's one at Foothill College, Foothill/Stanford. I would talk to an admissions person there to assess your probability of admission.
Okay.
Given who you are, and then before I quit medical school, and that would help me make my decision with a clearer heart.
Exactly. Like that's one of the factors. Another factor too is my medical school is in Southern California.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to disclose the name just for radio and publicity's sake, but it's just away from my family. I have all my friends, my parents all live in the Bay Area, and then, I have a girlfriend I'm leaving too while going to Southern California. So it's a lot that.
Yeah.
I'm going to be leaving, and I don't know if it's an immature decision to continue medical school and, do something faster.
I've
been struggling with that for quite a while.
I don't think so. I really think it's going to be tough going for doctors. Again, I do believe we're in an era. While Trump is an anomaly, it's an odd blip in a liberalization trend in America. And I think doctors are seen as haves. As some callers to the show are often talking about redistribution, and that the doctors are haves, and there's going to be ever more pressure to take from the doctors to give to lower paid practitioners. And that's going to be embedded in what will be the future version of Medicare for all. It'll probably be single payer. So I really think there's going to be a great flattening of the pay hierarchy, and I think physician assistant is really the smart way to go. But I would specialize again in something that you would love. If you're a novelty nut, then fine, then just be a primary care provider in the physician assistant space. But if you have this, unless you care a lot about AIDS or whatever, there are physician assistants who specialize in particular conditions, or children, or gerontology. Try to develop a niche that fits who you are as a person. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Another thing too, it's like me to kind of leave medical and pursue, physician assistant. I don't know, mentally it feels kind of like I haven't achieved anything. Like I feel like I'm quitting something and starting something else and not going anywhere,
Dear caller, one of my most treasured beliefs is that status is often the enemy of contentment.
Huh.
So many unhappy executives, lawyers, doctors, I said most of my client base is college presidents, executives, lawyers, nonprofit executives, and there's as much unhappiness there, and part of that unhappiness comes from the unbelievably virulent competition that exists at those prestigious tiers. People do so much for prestige. Lawyers my daughter's a lawyer. My daughter is a lawyer for the Justice Department in Washington, D.C., U.S. Justice Department. And, what lawyers will do to win, you're dealing with brilliant people who will do whatever it takes to win. That is not a formula for happiness.
Huh.
And so, if you can get past the American way of status being the goddess, the gold, the brass ring, the gold ring, you often can be happier. Some of my happiest clients have mid-level lives where they're not pressured so much and can be as ethical and not rushed and still make a middle-class living and have time for your creative outlets, for your music, for your art, for your writing, for love.
Right.
Status
the thing, too. It's like I come from a poor upbringing, so
I
have a lot of pressure to succeed.
Screw that. That is the nouveau riche. I really think that in many ways it is why some of the children of long-term wealth actually choose to not go that route because they see the price that their parent paid to get that 4,000 square feet in Danville. There are a hell of a lot of people who, after working as doctors, lawyers, executives, go home and get themselves stoned or their fourth martini in their 4,000 square feet.
Yeah.
Life is getting, and with all the other complications of the long commutes, which make life crazy for everybody, and frankly, the tension that exists among people around race, class, gender, people cannot talk as openly as they used to. There's a great deal of, people are tense. You walk down the street and you look at you, they say the eyes are the windows to the soul. And you look between people's eyes and you see stress.
Yeah.
Nobody looks at each other anymore. They look down, they look away. They have furrowed brows. And in many ways, while especially in public radio, we tend to denigrate society's haves, the amount of suffering that those people have despite having played the game, gone to school for a zillion years, sucked up to the boss, played office politics, did that competitive lawyer or doctor thing, is huge. And sometimes a more moderate road, maybe Aristotle was right about the golden mean.
Yeah, I mean, part of it, too, is I feel like it's my only way out of, you know, the upbringing I had. I mean, like, I grew up poor, so, like, one will be guaranteed, you know, not living that lifestyle.
I'm not asking you to be a barista, which, by the way, is going to be automated anyway. They're already testing. Bosch has an automated barista. No, physician assistant is not a path to poverty. It's a path to middle-class life.
I mean, I'm completely fine with being a physician assistant. I think my only concern is, you know, just my lack of kind of the preparation to be a PA. I mean,
good question.
Obviously you have to have shadowing experience, you have to have clinical experience, so I think the application process in itself would be a whole other kind of project to set up for.
Well, I want you to not only to shadow, but if you would, if by any chance, I mean, a guy who is in medical school, one of the ways that they also, they value different kinds of experience, they want you to have experience, but like medical scribes, believe it or not, are considered useful experience because you are trailing doctors and nurses and other people as they are seeing patients and transcribing important things. You know, there's many ways to get experience, and in medical school you have plenty of opportunity for that kind of thing.
Right.
You know, even being a medical patient, you know, when I teach my class at UCSF, they have these amazing, wonderful mock patients. Who, you know, and then there are these amazing discussions. Well, you don't get to sit on the discussion, but there's ways to gain expertise in a non-traditional way. Or be an EMT. It's amazing how short the training is for an EMT. And maybe in light of your and being in second year medical school already, you've got, you know, you maybe that experience already is enough to at least give you an edge. That's why I'm begging you to go talk to a couple of admissions people in PA schools. Okay, I'm looking at the clock.
I'm definitely
going to
do that.
Dude, the show is essentially over, so I do wish you the best of luck. Do remember, status can be, not always, can be the enemy of contentment.
All right, excellent. Thank you so much for having me, and this was very helpful, and I definitely appreciate all the advice you gave.
My pleasure. I do my best. That much I can tell you. Only got a few seconds left. I try to fill it as well as I can with stuff, so I'm just going to read with you another tweet or two that I think is of interest. It's relevant. The middle class is getting ever more squeezed. And so it's racing. I'm seeing it happen. Racing ever more frantically to try to avoid getting sucked down into poverty. And the final one, I was on the jogging trail yesterday, or a couple days ago, and somebody said, I hear that guy got a $75,000 job. I'm going to wear my hottest outfit and manage to bump into him. Be careful about people who are after you, not for love, but for money. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Jean Marie Asaturo, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers. And I know you're sick of hearing the cliche, you don't get a second chance to make a first impression. But there's a lot more to it than smiling and standing straight. I'm going to talk with Andy Murray, author of First Impressions. By the way, if you were one of the callers, one of the first callers, and didn't, did you get their addresses and names? Okay, great. So until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.